Welcome to the Own Your Choices, Own Your Life podcast. I know you are here wanting to change and rewrite your story. You are desiring to step into the impact that you know you are here to create. I am here to guide you with the proven tools and strategies used by myself and our speakers to support you in taking radical responsibility in your life and learning how to own your choices to change your story. My name is Marcia Van Weinsberg. I am a storytelling business coach, master NLP trainer, speaker, podcaster, and 7 times published author. My clients have found freedom and purpose from overcoming their shame stories and learning how to share them with the world. I am so grateful you are here. Let's get started. Welcome back to the show. Today we are speaking with Kim Cordy. Kim is a sensory perception and emotion management strategist. What an incredible conversation this is. Kim was born with a curious mind. However, she didn't always use that gift to its fullest potential. After suffering through a significant life event, she realized developing her curiosity muscle would help her in her own healing. Further, as a business consultant, she loves repeatable processes and procedures. She's known for simplifying the complex. She would tell clients that ultimately she was so lazy that she wanted to find the most efficient and simplistic way to enhance their business systems. She did the same with her emotions, and thus was born the premise behind Yucky, Yummy, Savory, and Sweet, Understanding the Flavors of Emotions. Here she poses the questions, what if instead of relying on comfort emotions like comfort food to get us through the day, we became 5-star Michelin chefs of our experiences? Her unique approach to emotional awareness and emotional intelligence offers an innovative way to create a connection to our emotions by using something familiar to us, like food. She explores how we experience our emotions from a combination of senses, including what we see, hear, touch, taste, and smell. Her book suggests that just like the developed palate of a chef, we can distinguish between different flavors of food. We can also increase our ability to capture the flavors of our emotions by enhancing our awareness of the senses of how we feel inside of our bodies. She believes that we aren't born with built-in emotional responses for every life event. However, we are born to feel emotions, and the emotion we feel is entirely up to us. This is a fantastic conversation as we equate food tasting sensing to our emotions and how to learn more about ourselves when it comes to emotions. Subconscious reprogramming, thoughts, patterns, words, all the things that we think and that we move through in order to create lasting change is what we dive into in this episode. Welcome to the show today, Kim. I am thrilled to have you here.
I am thrilled to be here. Sincerely thrilled.
Well, we've already had a good conversation before we even started. And so I wanted to dive in and talk a little bit about you're an author, right? You're a published author. Tell us the name of your book.
It's called Yucky, Yummy, Savory, Sweet, Understanding the Flavors of Emotions.
Okay. So can we just start there? Flavors of emotions. What does that mean?
Flavor is a combination of senses. So taste and flavor are different. And when you detect the flavor in your food, it's using your sight, your sense of smell, texture plays into how you experience the foods and the flavors. Like you might not think as much about that, but think about how you respond to certain textures and it can impact the flavor for you. Then you also have hearing, we know can impact how you experience food and the flavor of it might be more delicious to you just because there's beautiful music going on and the ambiance around you. So this is why I compare emotions to flavors, because we are a product of our senses. Our emotions are a product of our senses. What we see, what we hear, what we smell, you know, all of these things are the ingredients for how we feel. But more importantly, how we feel is a sense. It's called interoception. And interoception is the sensory system that tells us how we feel inside of our body, which also informs the brain, how we feel and how it needs to respond. For instance, we have an upset stomach or there's pains in our gut. Well, the brain's going to make us aware of that pain because it wants us to do something to take care of it. Like our heart's beating all the time. We don't even notice it until it gets to a point where it's racing and then we notice it. So those sensory systems are the ingredients for our feelings and our emotions.
Yeah, I know I'm going to love this one. So as we dive in, like just really in the sense that we come from, a lot of us come from a culture or a time where we didn't know how to feel emotions. We actually were not, we were kind of, you know, don't feel it, push through, keep going. And right. I love this concept that it is like, what are our emotions telling us? And because you're taking it and you're actually equating it to something that we can all relate to, which is flavor, then it becomes something that we can actually start to understand, is understanding our emotions more. What changes when we learn how to understand our emotions more?
Everything. When you think about it, it's a self-awareness tool. When you can identify how you're feeling in a moment and not, I mean, how many people, when you ask, well, how do you feel about that? Well, I don't know. Do you want to do this? Oh, I don't know. Like and that's really simplified. Like, what do you want to eat? I don't know. I mean, but when you can't identify your feelings in situations, when you're angry, and we use anger as the umbrella of emotion for all of the more finite feelings below. And I like to equate this to a chef. So if you are an untrained palate, because that's where we you know, absorb our flavors, so to speak. If you're an untrained palate, unlike a chef, or aren't born with all this, you know, the abilities, you don't notice all the fine bits and pieces of a recipe or what the ingredients in some dish, where a chef can taste something and say, oh, too much cumin, not enough salt. I like this combination. It needs to be a little thicker for this type of a recipe. And it notices all these things because it's trained. Mm-hmm. Whereas we could taste it and go, oh, well, that's really good. This is delicious, and not be able to get all the subtleties of the flavors within it. And it's those subtleties that help us to distinguish between our various emotional states. So if you think about spaghetti or things that are made with tomatoes, what if everything was just sauce when it's not? You know, sauce can have lots of different ingredients. And yes, there might always be garlic and tomatoes and onion, but there could be different seasonings, different proteins, maybe some cheeses. And so it's that relationship, if we can have to being comfortable with noticing flavors, it's the same system that helps us to notice our feelings inside. So it's being able to get comfortable and notice like, oh, I'm feeling this way when I'm in love, but I'm feeling this way when I have a crush on somebody, and noticing the difference between anger and just being upset or nervous and anxious or just maybe a little uncomfortable. See what I'm saying?
I do. And it's interesting because you called anger like the umbrella emotion. And I feel like that is when it comes back to NLP terms, we actually store in our body. We actually have to learn how to release emotions based on the order, which sounds really silly, but it is the anger. Anger is the very first. Anger is this big shell that actually can block out all of these other emotions. So anger comes first. Anger, sadness, fear, shame, guilt, and hurt. And I just say that because sometimes we see a person who is very angry, right? We see them as an angry person. When you can learn to work past some of those shells or that umbrella, as you call it, it's actually somebody who's using anger because they're so sad. There's so much sadness that's there. And emotions can really get intertwined. And to add to that, we only ever use our own lens, right? So how we can put the same situation down for two people, they could perceive it completely different because we all have our own lens with how we see a situation or how we see the world. So I find it really fascinating as you're explaining it this way. And I'm just so curious, like, where did this concept come from?
Actually, what sparked me and where it came from are two different places. So I'll go back a little further. And I just want to say one thing real quick, where you call it the lens, what their lens is, I call those our recipes. And that they're the recipes that we have in our bodies that we use that our brain cooks up given the perceptive ingredients. So the inspiration was just, you know, a lifetime of pain. I was raised by an alcoholic mother. I was treated inappropriately as a young girl more than once. And, you know, had a lot of pain and lost my mother at age 30. And I got married to someone who I thought was going to be the person, you know, who was going to love me, really, really love me, protect me, take care of me. And we ended up getting a divorce 9 years later. He cheated on me. And it was kind of literally, because I wrote another book about it was really my first entree into really focusing on internal things. But it was a moment when I was laying on the floor of my condo, packing it up because I was moving to San Francisco from San Diego, and I laid there forever. And when I got up, I was like, I can't let this happen to me again. It literally had gone from light to night. And I just was paralyzed by all this. And it's like, I cannot let this happen to me again. And that's what got me on the journey. And I always felt like, okay, this got me a little further. And this got me a little further. And then I read this book because I became very interested in the brain. I became very interested in how. I'm very curious in how things work. What makes this happen? And it was when I read this book called How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. This is where I learned about, you know, how we use perceptions, how our brain constructs emotions, much like our chefs construct recipes. And it really made so much sense to me because we're at all times, and I'm not even just talking emotions, I'm talking everything is a product of memory. And memory, experiences, learning, it's all the same. And I know you know this because of NLP, but it's all the same. And so we are constantly constructing and our brain is constantly predicting. So then how do we get better at predicting? And it's by understanding the recipes that it's using, trying a better way to understand the recipes that it's using, and then trying to break those down, maybe change them, just like we would something that our mom used to cook that wasn't healthy for us. And we, instead of using lard, use some other ingredient, you know? And when you can relate it to food and see like, oh yes, like I taste this different. I experience my body different. And what's so important about this is communication. This is the first level communication that takes place. When our body communicates to us and we've learned to shut it down, it's important to learn how to create that relationship again, how to build a communication, and how to understand that what it's telling you isn't always true. Mm. And we think our feelings are facts, and they're not. And so when we get to be familiar with our brain making what's called prediction errors, and maybe our memory of an event was faulty, or more importantly, maybe it wasn't complete, because when we're in a fear state, what do we focus on? Fear. And so we could be missing all kinds of components or pieces of that event. But when we're in a non-fear state, when our nervous system isn't saying, warning, warning, Will Robinson, we're more open. So we can take in more of what's going on and get a bigger, better picture. And this is where that, I call it humility, or that understanding of our own internal frailties of how we're made, that gives us that ability to go, I could be wrong here. And I think that is where growth happens.
Oh, it's 100% agree. And I love what you're saying there because it's just tying in so much. I heard Joe Dispenza say it recently that I think it's anything past 2 years, our memory is less than 50% accurate. Mm.
And the reason is because we recreate it every single time.
Right.
Memory is not, I don't know if that's entirely true. I can't say, but either way, they know for sure that we recreate our memories. And with our memories come our emotions of that memory or how we believe we felt at that time. It's stored in there. And those memories and that those ingredients are what we use for our thoughts. They're what we use for our decisions. So that's why it's so important to listen, because when we start listening to what's going on, we can start to decipher the bad recipes from the good recipes and just create the communication that extends to people beyond us. And so we're able to communicate with others better too.
Yeah, that's so powerful. This is that piece of like building, like having a better communication system within ourselves and our own bodies before we can even build a better communication system with somebody else. Like, how did you learn how to tap in and build a better communication system within yourself? Because you, as you share the first part of your story, like to then becoming a published author, like being so versed in this language, what were some of those early steps like for you to build a better system within your own body, listening, better relationship with fear and better communication?
I think a lot of it had to do for me was knowing I might have this wrong. And it really was humbling, quite honestly, because I was like, whoa, like, you know, how I've perceived situations and I have less fear about things now, because I talk about this in my book. You know, if you are in fear, you can't be in any other emotion. And so if you can go from fear to being cautious, and then from cautious to being curious, that allows you the space to not be ruled by this emotion, fear. And it allows me to experience situations more fully. And I think too, it allows me to have compassion and empathy and understanding for the people who, you know, I feel have wronged me or some of the things in my past. And so that helps me to move through life better and not be ruled by these emotions that were heavy in my life, like my alcoholic mother, seeing her differently, seeing the people who impacted me negatively. You know, they say hurt people hurt other people. There's always that underlying lack of self-confidence that drives much of the cruelty in this world. And so this is my goals, to have my self-confidence, having confidence in me, knowing me, being happy with me. And that comes with this internal conversation that I have with myself. And being able to notice how I feel in my body and stop and say, oh, what am I feeling here? It makes gigantic difference. But if you don't have that ability, if you can't connect, that's why I wrote the book. Because I even actually say, just start with noticing food. Just start with noticing little things in your body. My niece is autistic. She's got some other things. But I learned about a woman who teaches neurodivergent adults and children how to connect to their body, because the same feelings that we get when we are sick, the same system, interoception, tells us when we have an emotion. So, you know, that urge to eat is interoceptive signals. The urge to cry, you know, or feeling sad, these are interoceptive signals. So we can get those confused. So this is why, too, our ability to take care of our health is even impacted by receiving interoceptive signals. And what this woman does is she teaches neurodivergent people to listen to their body, to notice so that they can understand when they're sick or when they're angry. Because sometimes we'll have a feeling and we're just like, we're angry, but maybe we're actually just sick and we can't connect to the feeling.
Okay. So I love this. And I want to ask, a person listening to this says, okay, but Kim, you don't understand what it's like. My fear is paralyzing me. I hear this. I do hear this from people. What do you say to them when somebody says, but my fear is paralyzing me?
I would take them through an exercise and I would say, okay, whatever their name is, I'll just say Susan. That came out of the woodwork in my brain. Susan, what has to happen for you to feel fear? And then ask again, what has to happen for you to feel fear? And then ask again, Susan, what has to happen for you to feel fear? Susan, what has to happen for you to feel fear? And start going down the list of what has to happen for you to feel fear. And then I'd also start tracking, ask Susan to track how often her fears are realized, because most of the time we get those wrong. So those are the two things. But in that action of questioning those what has to happen to feel fear, and I usually incorporate not just the negative emotions, but the positive emotions that you want to feel, because you're missing out on those. And so what has to happen for you to feel them? And you start to see how a lot of the things that have to happen for you to feel fear, it's like, wait, you know, you start to see them on paper and you're like, well, wait, that doesn't make sense. And then all of a sudden you're seeing your fears on paper that's coming from, and I think you know this too, when you're rapid asking questions, this is coming from the subconscious mind. This is not coming from you thinking about it. Now I just go boom, boom, boom. What else has to happen? And then all of a sudden you've got it on paper and you're looking at them and maybe that's not there. And then when you start to see how much those fears are impacting you, feeling the feelings that you want more of, And if these feelings aren't true, then it gets real revealing. And those fears are driving your life, not you. And if they're not real, if they're not true, or if they're much more manageable, I mean, what the heck? Let them go.
Okay, you can say that. It's like the fears are driving our life. And if they're not real, right? They're not real. They're imagined. They're not even always based on accurate data. And we don't even understand sometimes what's happening here. And so when you say ask those questions over and over, like when you can get a client into a fast response, that's a subconscious response, which is exactly right. What you just said. And so sometimes you can stop, if you're just listening to this, you can stop and ask, like, what is it that I'm afraid of? And you might say, I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah, exactly.
And so ask again and ask again. Or the question that I always pose with clients is like, I know you don't know, but if you did know, what would the answer be? And they're like, what? Like it. And so these are just,
that's a great one.
Wording subconsciously, right? Is that the only way to break a subconscious pattern that we have on repeat is to consciously interrupt it. So that's exactly what you're talking about. It's like really taking it consciously interrupting a pattern. Some people will subscribe to fear because it keeps them safe, right? It keeps them safe. And it's so interesting because it also comes down to a definition of what safety means to us and what we feel is safe. Yeah.
Yes. And then that also becomes a question of what has to happen for you to feel safe. Can I share a story that I share in my book? Because I think this can illustrate fear and why we if we can stop in that moment and become either cautious or curious, that it might take us out of that feeling. I heard this actually in some crazy movie that I watched, and this guy was I can't remember everything was going on, but he said, once a snake is a rope, it can never be a snake again. And I said, well, what does that mean? Like, of course, I'm ridiculously curious. So I looked into the story behind it. And it comes from this Buddhist story of a monk. He's walking down a country pathway on his way home to the village. And all of a sudden, he sees something coiled and thin on the ground. And he goes, snake. And he jumps back and he's like, oh my gosh. He goes, I bet it's poisonous. How am I going to get home? Look, it'll be dark. I'm not going to be able to get back. It's a long way from where I come. And he'd have to go back the another route that would get him home for sure in the dark. And he's just going through all this stuff because what am I going to do with this poisonous snake? So finally, he puts together like a makeshift torch because I guess he figured he could burn it. And he gets closer and it's a rope. And he's like, oh, I could have gone by this whole time. So off he goes. So if he hadn't taken that caution, he was almost forced into caution to make this thing. He takes his torch and he pokes, you know, if he hadn't tried to check it out, but even more so, if he had gone the other way and given into his fears, he would have gone back the long way, gone to the village and let everybody know there's a snake along this pathway and be careful. And so now all these other people would have had fear, and all because he didn't look a little further to see that it was a rope that someone else had dropped. So here's this solid belief that there was a snake there when it was a rope. And curiosity would have cured that. Also, if there was more experience, if they had been an experienced snake handler, they would have known that. But I think if you had just looked a little harder, you would have seen it. And so this is where our fear gets us in trouble, but it also creates fear for other people when we repeat these fears of ours as facts when they might not be. And because they're so limiting and because they impact us physically so detrimentally, the stress of fear on the body causes all types of health issues. You're just compounding the unnecessary. So that's my favorite story to tell about how we can get emotions wrong and how curiosity can help you clarify it.
I love that. I love the story, and I love the explanation of, you know, curiosity helping you to re-look at like perspective on fear. And all of a sudden it starts to, like, I think when you can open up curiosity, you can now be open to other solutions because you take the blinders off. So it's like all of a sudden we now are not with the blinders. Now there's other possibilities for how we can find our way through something. Fear is like, fear does create that fight, flight, let's response. And there are times where I will feel something come up and it's like, okay, there's no lion, Marsha. Like, there's no lion chasing you. You're fine. Like, it's fine. But it's amazing what can happen. And if we don't know how to process that experience, that actual visceral experience inside of us, then, and if we don't move in some way, shape, or form, because fear is about getting us to move, whether it's moving back or moving forward, then lack of movement with fear creates anxiety. And then all of a sudden, anxiety now is like it's like rising up in this process. It's amazing when you're talking about this and how those emotions, what they can do. And I love how you've taken this analogy with your book. And I do want to talk a little bit more about your book. But in this sense, as you started to do this work on yourself to understand saying, okay, I'm not going to be back here again. I don't want to do this again. I'm not repeating this. Like, our subconscious mind does not understand negative. So we always have to be mindful where I was speaking about, like, where we're going and what we're creating. Where did you go, and how long was that process of the work that you did with yourself to coming to a point of saying, no, I want to take this and I want to write a book and talk about it. I want to share it, because that is not a small leap either.
No. So just because I read this book, but that was really just the beginning. I have done so much reading into consciousness, into understanding. One of my favorite books is by Candace Pert. It's called Molecules of Emotions. And so what happens when we store our memories, right? So our neurons have these, they're wired together, but one particular neuron will release this pack of peptides, and there's neuropeptides that will tell other neurons in their group what to do. But it's also a peptide that goes to the body. And so the peptides that go to the body have receptors. It's an all at once. They just go boom. They just go out and they communicate to the body, which is what informs us. So it's this whole beautiful process that goes outwards from a single neuron, and it produces what we have as feeling. And then that was super impactful to me, but also consciousness is super important, because the more conscious we are, if we have a higher level of awareness or self-awareness, then it gives you such greater capabilities in life, and to not be ruled by fear, especially. But the process took me, 5 years, learning. I started my first book was in 2000. I wrote it in 2008. It was one of those things, because I was in pain. And then it's called The Perfect Heart, Creating and Maintaining Love-Life Balance. But then that was, to me, was like child's play, because this book was, in 2017 was when I read it. And I mean, I went deep and hard into learning about it. And that, like I said, with consciousness, understanding brain chemistry a little bit better, understanding, I knew about cooking because I've been a foodie, my husband are foodie. And in fact, I named this progression in the book, it's called The Emotion Chef. And so it starts out like as a station chef, where all you do is you just work on one thing. A station chef in a kitchen, all you do is work on salads or an appetizer. And so you, as a station emotion chef, that's all you work on, is connecting to feelings. There's some exercises in the book to kind of like just notice the feelings in the body. And that is ground level one, right? To do that. And so I will say that, we don't always notice the changes in us as much as other people. And I've had my sister notice the change in me, because I'm a lot less judgmental. I'm a lot less, I'm a lot less of a lot of things, and I'm a lot more compassionate and empathetic. And in fact, my whole relationship, one thing I will tell you is that my whole relationship from practicing this, my relationship with love has changed. I was stingy, and people who know me would say, oh, that's not you, but it really was. And, if you were in, you were in, if you were out, you were out. But love for me was, given very discreetly, not, like to love some stranger. I even came up with a word, a transition word. It's called respassion. It's a combination of respect and compassion, that I have I can't tell you the definition off the top of my head that I have, but it's that respect and care for that best for someone, no matter what they look like, no matter what they sound like, just to have that. And that was a great stepping stone for me to have that kind of universal love, to love strangers in a way. It's not the same as family, but it's still beyond what I think I was showing and sharing inside of me. And so that's the distinction, those flavors that I'm talking about. And so these are some of the changes with me that I've noticed, and that like my sister noticed. I had a coach who said, I've never met anyone, I think, who has that knows themselves and can look and judge myself so fairly and have such self-awareness, because now I can look at myself and go, well, is that really? And that's big stuff in my book for me.
It's huge. That's absolutely huge. I think that self-awareness to be able to look at maybe what you're feeling and experiencing and not create a story or judge yourself for that.
Yes, just the story is a better story.
It's okay. No, but it's because I recognize it's that. True. Like, being able to see it and say, oh, that's interesting. I was like, I usually become that's interesting. And old versions of me would be like, I'd have a pretty good story created really fast and what that meant. So I think that that's a really powerful explanation in how you're sharing that. And then the other piece that hits me in something just to elaborate and ask on is this piece on, compassion and having that compassion towards others. I just posted a video on my dog this weekend, and I love my dog. And somebody sent me a message I'd never had a conversation with. And she said, oh, I can tell by the way you treat your dog that you're a very compassionate person. That's so nice for the people in your life. And I was like, that's interesting. That was very interesting. And I said, you know, I think that I have more compassion, but what I'm actually most proud of is that I have more compassion with myself that I never had. That allows me to have more compassion with others. I think that so many women, I'm going to pick on them for a second, very much in the martyrs of like, I have so much compassion for others, but I don't have any time for myself. I'm like, but you're only barely touching the tip of the iceberg of what you could give to others because your tank is so empty because you're not putting that compassion back on yourself. And that sounds like something that you learned to do is giving that compassion back to yourself through this process.
Yes. And to love myself is self-love. I just did a video about there's two types of self-love. There's it's French terms. And I was looking into the philosophy of self-love and the whole idea of loving yourself and caring for yourself is much different than being narcissistic type of self-love. And so it's being able to recognize that difference where you're taking care of yourself because you want the best for yourself as much as you do for other people. But I just wanted to say one thing about stories before I forget, because how many of us in our minds, like she made up a story about you. Mm-hmm. She said in her mind, she wrote that story that you were compassionate in general because you were compassionate of how you behaved with your dog.
Yeah.
And that's all in her head. And so when we see people, we make up stories about them. And one of the best things that I have caught myself doing is like saying, I don't know. Because my story that I make up about a person is going to impact how I feel about them. Mm-hmm. And if one of the best things I ever did was to, when I would be out in public and maybe I got started one day. I was in Trader Joe's and there was this guy with this huge, what do they call them? Like a big gauge in his ear. It was gigantic. And I was raised by my dad with no tattoos, no this, you know, men don't have long hair, you know, like he was in my head. And I looked at him and I said, oh my gosh, that must have taken such an effort to get that to that size. I said, what is behind? Like, is this just something that you've been passionate about? I said, that's a real dedication. And he was so happy that I asked and he shared a quick story. And so now I got the right story. I didn't have my dad's story. So it just got to be a thing where I started finding something I liked in someone else that I normally would have been like, you know, the old stories come up and just say, oh, I really love your hair. Like, that's beautiful. And finding something beautiful and sharing it. And it's kind of just like these magic moments that can happen. And it's what I do to keep me from creating my own story about people when I'm typically going to make a negative one.
I think it's second nature. I think it's second nature. It's not until we consciously stop that pattern, I think it's second nature. And I always, one of the things I always say is like, I never know a person's story. I know what they let me see. I don't know their story, right? And whatever they mm-hmm. let me see, then I'm still going to make a story based on that. So it's a really interesting piece that can happen. And when I look at it, I'm curious, like, how are you, you've kind of alluded to it, but how are you different now compared to before you went through this process? Like the person who was on the floor saying, I can't do it this way anymore. I'm not doing it this way anymore. How are you different and how is your life different now after doing this kind of work and learning and now putting it together in a book and sharing it and speaking about it? How is life different for you now?
I am able to, I'm very much more observant of, try to be observant of people to take in more information. So I put a lot more effort into actual ingredients that I wanted in a new husband. Like if I were to get married again and I got those ingredients.
Oh, I love that.
Yes. I I think I am definitely more compassionate. And, you know, a lot of these things I already talked about, you know, I'm calmer. I'm a very controlling person, which is makes a whole lot of sense when you're a young girl having out of control moments in life. But I have learned to give up so much control and to question the things that I'm afraid of. It's not like I'm never going to be perfect. And I also stopped trying to be perfect. I was always trying to be perfect. I'm not trying to seek perfection anymore. I have so much like, oh, I made a mistake. Oops, I got this wrong. You know, before, like my dog barking back there, it would have, you know, I would have made me nuts. He's never done that. And now he's asleep because he finally gave up. But it's a good thing he's so cute or he might be in trouble. But yeah, I'm not that person who is going to let someone control me or who doesn't love myself enough. And I think that's really, really key, is because I have more love and respect for myself. This situation, like, I don't think I would have married my first husband if I would have had more of that. And I think that if I was really, truly aware of my emotions, there was a lot of decisions that I never would have made if I wasn't so desperate for a bad definition of love. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to say it's not a completely healthy definition of love. So, yeah, I mean, I cannot talk enough about self-awareness and learning to love yourself for who you are, because guess what? Then any haters, any of this other stuff, it just doesn't matter. And your self-esteem, your self-worth goes up because it's not measured on someone else. It's measured by you. And I was always measuring myself by other people. And I learned to measure by myself, for me, by who I like, who I am. And yes, some of that comes with age, but I think we could get there quicker if we learned how to do it. Nobody showed me. Nobody taught me.
Oh, I love, thank you for sharing all of that. And if you're saying that, like, we could get there quicker by learning some of the tools and the things that you've shared, this is part of what your book does. This is part of how this can help, right? Like how it can help people to make those changes faster. So the ideal reader who's listening to this right now, who is that person and what will they gain from your book?
It's someone who's, I call it emotionally skittish. Mm. Or who maybe wants to learn a little bit more about their emotions. So I'm pulling in, this thing is so well referenced. I mean, I've got a lot of different references. So this isn't just coming, you know, my spewing my thoughts, but it's cooked up and it's the ingredients that I use. It's how I present it. And it's, I would say, emotionally skittish people. Like I think sometimes about the men who were told, don't feel, you know, that to me is such a shame. And then they wonder why they have problems in their relationships and why they can't feel love or find love. Like I said, the emotionally curious, mm-hmm. I mean, I really think we always have more to learn. And I know that I do, and I'm constantly looking to learn more. And I also think, you know, leaders. And if you're a leader in your family, if you're a leader of a group, if you're a leader of an entire organization or a city or a state, your inability to connect to information you don't want to hear makes a big difference in the lives of others. And so I'm hoping that this allows people to listen to information that they don't want to hear. Just because they don't want to hear it, right? Like willful blindness is a big problem in the world. And I have a chapter dedicated to that practically.
Listening to information that they don't want to hear, tell us what willful blindness is.
Willful blindness is cognitive dissonance. It's like not wanting to look at a situation because it goes against, it might make you feel bad. So there's a great book by Margaret Heffernan called Willful Blindness, something about ignoring the, you know, things to our peril, but it's called Willful Blindness by Margaret Heffernan. And she gives the story of this doctor who was a female in the 50s who basically discovered, because back in the day, you x-rayed everything, pregnant women, feet, all the whole body. You were x-rayed when you went in to buy shoes, for fitting shoes. And she discovered the link between birth mortality and disease, you know, of children, certain diseases, and x-rays. And it took 20 years for them to ban it. And it's just like, why, when the evidence was there? The evidence never changed. And that's the whole thing. Like, things, that rope doesn't change, right? That rope is still a rope. It's not a stake. And so they did not accept it. And so imagine the feeling of losing income, the feeling of being a baby killer, the feeling of having to admit you were doing something bad. That's willful blindness.
Wow. There's a lot of things I can see that fall into that.
Yes, a lot.
There's a lot, actually. There's a lot. Wow. This has been like fascinating. I love it. Tell us the title again of your book, because I think I can't wait to read this.
It's called Yucky, Yummy, Savory, Sweet, Understanding the Flavors of Emotions.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing all of this. Like, plus you've given us so many different resources, which I love, because I love to be able to share, you know, you've got a lot of substance in everything that you're sharing too. Because I think of all the things that are stopping people from going after what they want to do in their life, what they want to create, or how they can learn to reframe something that they're walking through and experiencing. And so much of it comes down to fear, the emotions, the stories that we're telling ourselves. And you've created a resource to be able to support people. And yeah, that might be your story today, but it doesn't have to be your forever story. Learning, there's so many ways you can learn something differently. And when we understand our body's just trying to protect us half the time, it's not because we're broken or there's something wrong with it. It's just doing what its job was. Now we can see it differently.
But it's also, and I agree there, but it's telling us, it's informing us not just to protect us, but also to help us lean into the things that are good for us. And so even like love, which you would think, oh, isn't that always good for us? No, it can be very perilous if you're loving the wrong person. So you may it's there to tell us what we want, what we don't want, what we like, what we don't like, you know, and so it's going to inform us both ways. And when we can't feel it, when we push them down, we're also going to learn, you know, lack the things that we might be needing to lean into to help us to feel good too. You see, does that make sense?
Oh, it does. It makes perfect sense. So then my question for you is going to be, somebody listening to this who says, okay, but I don't trust my feelings, because I don't understand how to trust and listen to what those feelings are. What would you answer to that?
So if you don't trust them, then that means that you don't know them very well. And I am a huge, huge fan of journaling. And it's another subconscious exercise, and I'm sure you've recommended this in your podcasts with your clients, with everybody, and I do too. You just write uncensored, no spelling correction, no anything. And if it makes no sense at all, you just keep writing the nonsense. And if you don't have anything to say, just write, I don't have something to say, I don't have something to say. And then all of a sudden, man, it comes out. And you might find that your trust about your feelings has to do with trust about other people's feelings for you. And you'll go like, wait, it's not me. And then you'll start to get this communication. It's all communication, right? Mm-hmm. It's all communication. And you'll start to build your confidence in your ability to communicate. And it's just like getting to know yourself, honestly. And I also go back to those other exercises about tracking your anxieties, tracking your fears, tracking these things, and doing that exercise, like I said, about questioning, like, what needs to happen, because those are the recipes that we have in our brain. And those are the recipes our body holds. And so let's check them out. They might need to be cast aside.
I was going to say, we're going to check out those recipes and we're just going to tweak them. Like we can change them, right? We just change the recipe a little bit. I love this.
That's the power of it. We can change them. Mm. We don't have to eat the crap that we're served. Oh, sorry. Maybe I shouldn't have said that word. Oh, but we don't, you know, we've been served socially and in all kinds of ways, familial, bad food. And we don't have to accept them. We have so much power, you know, when we understand that our world lives in our head. Like we don't see, we experience what we see. If you and I look at red, I have no idea that we're looking at the same color red at the same time. I don't know. We are the experts of our experiences and it's up to us to change them. It's no one else's job. It's just not. Like if we respond to someone a certain way, that's on you, not on them.
Yeah, so powerful. It's so powerful. I love this conversation.
I do too. I love talking to you.
I feel like I could go like really deep on it too, because I am so fascinated. And this piece on curiosity, like I can honestly say that's when a lot of change started to happen for me, was in a space of like getting curious about why do I think that? Where did that come from? Whose is that actually? And a lot of it was just curiosity. Like instead of judgment, which I was really good at doing of myself, it was curiosity instead. And we start to look at ourselves differently. And I often say like, we cannot learn how to love ourselves and while hating everything that made us who we are. We actually can't hate all of those experiences because they've shaped us. And if we go back and change, we don't want to have to walk through crappy things, but we do. And because it's life. If we go back and change those circumstances, we aren't the same person today. And so it's shaped us. What we get to do with that and what we make that mean, that's our choice. We get to decide. And we can do something differently with it. So we're being taught these lessons. And sometimes we're being taught them over and over and over and over again until we stop and get curious and learn a little bit more about it. But I love how you've taken something that can be a very heavy concept and you've simplified it and added some relatability and some humor to it that I think is going to help so many people.
That's my goal, right? I mean, I see people who get mad at the drop of a hat. And, you know, I'm thinking, oh, if I could just help them. I think about people who are in prison, whose emotions, their inability to identify or manage them. And it breaks my heart. And I think of, you know, people who are supervisors or even employees. It's like they can be in this situation and you're like, why are they responding to it that way? And there's, it's like, if you could only like just examine your feelings a little bit more. And, you know, I just want to help. That's really honestly, like anyone who it helps, I know it's already helped a few people, but if I could help masses, it would make me very joyful. It's hard to go through life shut down. It's a much rougher life.
Oh. I think you just kind of summed up something there. Like it's hard to go through life shut down. And when you're not feeling those emotions or there's the miscommunication of them, then it is hard to go through. It is hard to go through life, but we want to not be shut down. We want to be able to experience. We want to be able to grow, be curious, learn from these.
Love.
Absolutely. All of those things. It's so fun.
Love and connect.
Yeah, it's the number one desire that people have, right? Is connection. It's they want to feel connection and we can't feel anything. We can't feel a connection. Like I can't feel a connection with you if I don't feel connected to me first. Like we have to start here first.
Exactly. 100%. And that's pretty much the premise of the book because we are all atoms made of atoms. Everything in this universe is made of atoms. And we are all connected by the fields that are make up these atoms. And it's yes, very quantum physics, but it's very true. And so when we have that disconnect distraction from everything. What a lonely place. And, you know, I've been in that lonely place. I've been in a ginormously lonely place, and it's just not any fun. Mm-hmm. So being able to share and share ourselves with other people and not be afraid to share who we are with other people is so important. And that's what I'm about.
Well, I'm grateful for the work that you do and for having you here to be able to share this. This has been such a deep thinking episode, which I love. I absolutely love. Where can people connect with you, find your book, all of the things?
KimCorty.com. And at KimCorty.com, you can get a little preview of the book. It will, you just download, you sign up and download, and it doesn't cost anything, but it gives you the introduction and the first chapter. And that kind of lays out the premise of the book. Mm-hmm. And I'll just give you the first chapters named Opus One, Two Buck Chuck, and the Wine Snob. And it's the story of how we get our senses and our brain can get things wrong.
Oh, I love that. I cannot wait to read it. So your book is out now and available, right?
Yes, on Amazon.
On Amazon. Okay, perfect. Mm-hmm. Perfect. I'll make sure that we have everything linked in the show notes. I love this connection and everything that we chatted about today.
I feel the same way.
Yeah, it's been, and plus we talked before we hit record, which is always a good sign.
Right? I'm like,
I know.
We have to talk again.
We will. I have a feeling that we will. I have a feeling that we
do too.
Can I ask you, what lesson in life are you most grateful for?
The hard ones. Mm. Yes, definitely. Because when you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, the divorce was just such a dark period in my life, but it led to the most light and everything up until that point. And I think the hard ones, we need that contrast for real growth. And while it's not always pretty, we can make it pretty. And that's the key, is learning how to turn, you know, a bunch of lemons into lemonade. And when you have that power, that's a superpower.
That's a superpower. That's a superpower. We had some pretty good chats about superpowers too.
Yes, we did. And I love superpower talks because we all have them.
We all do. We all do. Thank you so much for being here, Kim.
Thank you. I enjoyed this tremendously. You were a fabulous host, and I just can't thank you enough for letting me be on your podcast, because I'm impressed. I said this ahead of time. I listened to several of yours, and I'm like, wow, I'm subscribing.
I love that. I love hearing that.
Yes.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Own Your Choices, Own Your Life. If you love this episode, I invite you to tag me on social media with your takeaways or share it with a friend. Please, if you feel called, take 30 seconds to leave a 5-star review, and I will be forever grateful. Until next time, remember, when you own your choices, you truly own your life.